You can hear me there, I guess. So just to let you know what we're doing with presentations, in case you didn't read the email that went out, things are basically confirmed now. We will have presentations next week. It will be hell week for the three of us. So I'm just going to do the presentation information
because
we're getting started. And
turn my watch is off. I'm sorry.
It's okay. So the three of us are going to be presentations 4 days next week, and then we will drop dead. You have the benefit of only having to do one night each. So Wednesday and Saturday we will be here. In fact, right there, 303, I believe. No, there.
How is it?
If it's 303, it's there.
Okay. So we couldn't get the dome, the one, the ace room?
No, we couldn't get the gas lounge.
I'm told it is in use next Wednesday night, in fact.
Wow, that's impressive.
Anyway, there's a nice room there with a good AV system, so we'll be fine there. Thursday and Friday, in Redmond, the usual room that the people in Redmond are in will be set. We'll send all this out and make sure it's on the list and the website, whatever, but the rooms are what we expected them to be, and the nights are what we expected them. So the situation is, if we take what people have requested, and a few people were nice enough to see the load and try to rebalance a little bit, Thursday night in Redmond is the killer night. We still have more than 18 people who have said, that's where I want to do my presentation. Friday night in Redmond is a little bit more room. So we may even say, Thursday, you're getting to the point where you don't have things ready. You can delay till Friday. Fortunately, we don't have people stacked at the end. We have people stacked at the beginning. So we have a little bit of flexibility there.
Did you tell them that you were providing beer on Friday?
I thought you guys were getting beer for us.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we'll do it better. Okay. So what we'd like to be able to do is, given that other than that things balance pretty well, and given that there is an incentive for you to be there on a less crowded night, because then you'll spend less time there, things are shorter, to maybe just try to let things go. So I think what we're going to have to do is cap Thursday. We have 18 people who want Thursday as their first choice and submitted on time. And there are a few people who came in late after a very clear deadline and said, oh yeah, Thursday is what I want too in Redmond. That probably isn't going to work. So we'll probably cap at that. But anybody who wants to slough off the other days should be okay. And other than that, everybody will be able to come to their first choice. So we'll send out some detailed confirmation to that effect. But basically, you get the night you want, and we will get to the best that we can compile a list of what presentations will be each night, so that people who want to come to other nights would be welcome to do so. Are there any questions about the presentations before Brian does the homework?
So is the plan still that you'll have a machine plugged in, or will be plugging around?
It'll be your choice. We will certainly have machines there. I'll have my machine, and I expect Brian and John will both have their machines. My machine USB is a little bit flaky on recently, so we can say, but yeah, we can do it either way. Yeah?
Is the 10-minute presentation including questions, or is that we're supposed to talk for 10 minutes and then time after for questions?
I don't think we've been very specific. I don't want things to go very long, so I think the idea is talk for at most 10 minutes, but, if you're done in 8 minutes, that's just fine. Yeah. 3 minutes is not so good. 6 might be okay. 8 is probably ideal. And at 10, we're saying, get off the stage. It's late.
Do you have a specific allowance for questions? We
have not... We're not going to set up a schedule with, 10 minutes and 5 minutes for questions, 10 minutes and 5 minutes for questions. it'll be just one after the next. So the idea will be we'll figure out an order, and you'll know when you're next. And while somebody's taking questions, if you have to do a laptop switch or whatnot, that gives you a couple minutes to set up. Or even if you're doing the same, we'll get the presentation out there. But that way we can just keep things moving reasonably quickly. So take a few questions while we're in transition.
Yeah, you did set some expectation that we would participate.
You're expected to participate. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody is going to have to ask a question of every talk. What we don't want is people sleeping in back and saying, why do I have to be here? There is real value in watching what other people are doing and figuring out this is research. This is trying to understand what's going on and, you know, learning a little bit about, you know, some ideas. Last time we did this, a lot of the presentations were really interesting and very much worth watching, and I think they'll be again this time. And we want to encourage that as much as possible. There's another question?
Oh, I was going to say that there is a bit of a tension because you mentioned grades would be partially on participation, so that tends to make people talk a lot. But you said time is important too.
There's a balancing act here. We want people to be awake. We don't want people to be loquacious, shall we say. So the idea is to be into it enough so that hopefully you'll have asked two or three good questions by the end of the evening. You won't have just sat there. That's the expectation. Not that you'll be, I've got to come up with some question on this. I don't know what to ask, but I've got to open my mouth. My mouth is going. I don't know what I'm saying. No. You don't have to get into that mode. Please. Okay, you want to get going? Anything else on the anything from Redmond on the presentation? Okay.
Thank you. Homeworks are in. Everyone's turning their homeworks.
Can I get everybody's homework here?
Okay. Stylus ready.
I think John's ready. These are the old ones.
Okay, good. Yeah, we're ready. Okay.
We're all set, John?
Yep.
Okay, so this problem set, handcrafted with tender loving care and perfection. The goal of this problem set is to try to get you to feel some of the practical problems that we run into when we actually try to deploy PKS. Thinking about revocation, thinking about some of the complexities in certs, stuff like that. So let's just dive into it. Problem one was all just straight computation. There was no trickery intended. There was no, I forgot 3 bytes in a header here. That wasn't the problem. This was all sort of straightforward computation. Sometimes it really is this simple, okay? So, again, here's what I've got up here is just, actual data. I downloaded the CRIL that morning when I created the problem set, so those numbers are real, and you were playing with real live data in terms of what they were. 1A was, assume 200 million users got to get a CRIL once every 14 days on average. That covers the websites that they're going to go interact with, because in that 14-day period, they're going to hit some number of websites that are running SSL that bought a cert from VeriSign. How much data does that cause in terms of a download? Well, you take 200 million users, you figure the CRIL's good for 2 weeks, you evenly spread out when it's going to expire for them, so 1/14 of them every day have to go download a CRIL. That's 14 million downloads per day. You're downloading 515K, roughly. That's 7.3 times 10 to the 12 bytes. Okay? That's the amount of data it's moving. It's a lot of data to move around. A lot of data around about a lot of sites that most of those users don't really give a damn about, actually, when you think about it. You're downloading a lot of data for sort of very little gain. And also, that's VeriSign's cost. They have to support that. Right? So that would say, well, gee, what happens if we go to an OCSP where we have users just go and ping the server? How many servers would they actually have to go visit and then ping to go get an OCSP response, assuming that the request response was 3K? One of the questions I got over the weekend was, well, why did you specify 3K for the request response and you only specified the download on the CRIL? Real simple reason. When we do CRIL downloads, 99 and 44 100% of the time, it's an HTTP GET. Okay, and so there's basically no upstream traffic and there's downstream traffic. When you're doing an OCSP, you actually have to craft a message up and there's some amount of traffic going up and there's some coming down. So to be really more of an apples-to-apples comparison, you ought to kind of look at sort of what the aggregate traffic is on that side. But it's mostly on the download, even on OCSP. So what do you have there? Well, assume you got to generate 7.3 times 10 to the 12 bytes of bandwidth per day. You divide that by 3 kilobytes per request response. That gives you 2.4 times 10 to the 9th OCSP round trips. I've done these all using scientific notation instead of kilobytes and megabytes because different people like to divide them in different ways, and I'm not going to get into that. Divide by 200 million users, and if every user hit about 12 SSL sites per day that they had to go download one of these things for, that would be the equivalent amount of bandwidth. Now, we're playing a little fast and loose here because these OCSP responses could last for 2 weeks, you could imagine. And would I really hit, 12 sites different every day times 14 days is 168 SSL sites. The number of SSL sites, yeah?
You didn't have to hit 12 that were on the bad list, not just 12 total.
Well, no, I have to hit 12 that I'm asking status information for. Right, because this is replacing the krill that I'm checking. So they could all be good. They don't all have to be on the bad list. Now, the question is, how many actual SSL websites does a typical user tend to interact with? I don't have actual numbers on that, okay? But I will bet if you think about how many you interact with on a regular basis, it's a heck of a lot less than 168 for a two-week period, right? In fact, you can probably count them on two hands. There's a couple of banks. There's maybe some, 401k type thing. You've probably got some small number of merchants you buy stuff from at eBay or something like that, when you purchase. Question here.
I'm just thinking maybe I'm missing something. In the first question, you come for 20 million divided by 14. In
right.
The second one, you're not doing that. All the users are going to the same.
What I'm looking at is, because I asked for how many requests per day on average per user. So if you've got 200 million users on the network, the reason I divided by 14 originally is that a krill is good for 14 days. Okay? So I have to download it once in that 14-day period. Right? That's why it's spread out. Okay? So there is some amount. And that's up to VeriSign. Right? VeriSign controls, when they issue the krill, how long it's good for. And so if they don't like that bandwidth cost, they can say that their krills are 30-day krills. But they're changing the risk parameters on it. So it's a trade-off. It's an engineering trade-off.
So VeriSign issues that particular krill every morning at 3
yes.
a.m.
Yes.
And so you have overlapping krills.
Uh-huh. That's right. But if you actually look at the krill, you'll notice that even though they update it and they put it out at 3 a.m., it's got a 14-day window on it.
Right.
Okay? So if you receive that krill, you are allowed to make your judgments on that basis for the next 14 days.
But at the end of 14 days,
at the end,
day 10, you're 10 days out.
At day 10, you're 10 days out. That's right. Your client is. Now, you could choose on your client to go and fetch more quickly. But if you have to make a decision on the basis of that information, VeriSign said, here's a statement, and the next update is 14 days later. If VeriSign really wanted to narrow their risk, they could say that krill is good for 24 hours. And then everyone would go hit them at 3 in the morning, or actually at 6 or 7 in the morning when they first got on and surfed for whatever they were surfing for.
Yeah.
And it would flood them by a factor of 14 on top of it. So again, engineering a risk trade-off.
So what happens at the end of the 14 days? At that point, the
typical client behavior is, well, after you hit what's called the next update date, you go back and you go see if there's a new krill there. Now, assuming the krill's there, you pull down a new krill and you toss the old one. If you can't get that, then you start to get into an iffy behavior, which is what happens when you have a stale krill. And is a stale krill better than no krill at all? Okay? Because now what you've been told is, I've got a stale hot list book, right? I've got that stale information. I'm supposed to be able to get new, fresh information, but there's a denial of service attack against VeriSign servers and I can't get there. So do I keep basing on the last information I got from them? Do I fail safe and say, well, I can't get anything that's current, I better not connect to any SSL website, or do I just kind of go with it? And that's actually client behavior, and it depends on how the client's configured as to what you do in that case. Probably you could probably run with the stale, but give a warning or something and hope the user has some idea when they see the dialogue what it happens. That's what goes on.
The ordinary automatic behavior
is to go refetch it and error them. There's a question back here.
So actually, if they... Thinking about our cybersecurity class last quarter. So the fact that the krills are good for 14 days reduces the effectiveness of a denial of a service attack against there, because if it's every 24 hours, for instance, then you'd only have to...
If you had, you'd have to keep it up for a shorter period of time before you timed everybody else out.
Yeah.
So that's correct. It makes it harder to time everyone else out. Then again, even if you're hitting 1/14 of the population, you know, that's still a non-trivial amount. But you're right. That's a good point. You know, the fact that you spread people out means that even if you have a DOS attack against it for some amount of time, you're not likely to stop everybody and freeze all traffic going. Right. That's a good point. And a question over here.
So I really don't understand what is this 14 days creel validity, because there is some liability very science.
Yep.
But then for sure, at the end of these 14 days, the creel will be outdated. Basically, there will be some revoked certificates during this period. So I don't understand what is 14 days, where it comes from. What is the liability for VeriSign? And could you give a specific example?
Well, it's their choice. So the way in which the Krill standard, like a cert, has a validity period in it. The Krill's validity period is not quite defined in exactly the same way. In a certificate, there's a time period that says this cert is not valid before a particular date, if not valid after a particular date. So you've got an exact time interval. In Krill's, there's a publication date and there is an expected date of next update. That's the way it's phrased in the standard. But the way it's interpreted is that Krill's valid as if it's when it's published, because you take the latest revocate confirmations available, and it's considered stale if it's past the next update date. You may still choose to use it. Now, why does VeriSign choose that particular period of time? Because, again, they've made this risk-reward trade-off. You're exactly right that they had to look at what's their risk of not getting information out.
And what is their risk?
Well, it kind of depends on the class of the cert and why they've revoked it. Okay, for low-class certs, the risk may be maybe little or nothing. There is some amount of insurance that they actually give. If you look at the contract that governs their operations that's referenced in all their certs, and they're called a certificate practice statement. And in some cases, they offer like $10,000 liability insurance to certain businesses. So if they certified like a class 3 business.
Basically, they calculated some probability.
Yeah.
Money associated with
it. That's right. And they've taken out some insurance, and I'm sure that what they've done is they've reinsured and offloaded the risk on that. But, you know, what would be the risk? That they misissue a cert for someone like Bank of America. Someone puts a phishing website up. There's some losses associated with something like that. They've insured against some that sort of thing. That's kind of what you're looking at there. And they just factored in that time period as part of the risk calculus, just like the credit card companies did back. Okay. Question 1C was to say, okay, if you look at the VeriSign Krill and you assume that they're servicing 500,000 servers, about 3% of those servers are revoked at any one period in time. 3% of the certs that have issued. That's about a reasonable rate if you think about it, in terms of what we've seen empirically. And in fact, it's 3% this time, and I went back and looked at the numbers from 4 years ago, and it was 3% 4 years ago. So their revocation rate seems to be roughly constant across their servers. Now apply that to issuing certs to users. This isn't really quite a fair comparison because users aren't actually as good as website operators at maintaining their keys. Users are actually more likely to get into trouble and have to need revocation. But assume that you are issuing certs to 60 million passport holders, how big would the Krill be? And that was just 3%, that's 1.8 million revoked, 35 bytes in entry, 63 million bytes. And that was the whole part of that question. Okay? Question 2. Questions 2 and 3 were about doing certificate enrollment. That is, assume that the client's got a signing key pair, an encryption key pair, and participates in a Kerberos realm with a CA and needs to get some certs on it. And the key thing here was two things. So KSPub and KSPriv are your signature keys. KEPub and KEPriv are your encryption keys. Obviously, it's a protocol design question, so there are a lot of possible answers to this. I'm going to give you a couple that give you the right flavor of what's going on. Your enrollment protocol had to do two things. It has to authenticate the client to the server somehow, and the big hint was you're in a Kerberos realm, and you could leverage Kerberos to do that. And you got to prove when a client submits to the server that the client actually holds the corresponding private key. You have to do what's called proof of possession. Okay? And proof of possession is the key thing that the CA wants to know. When the CA is going to bind a key to you and sign a cert, the CA needs some proof that you actually hold the private key. Signature keys, you sign something. With encryption keys, it kind of depends on what you've got, and we'll talk about that just in a bit. So if you've got RSA, and you're using RSA keys for signature and encryption, and you can actually use your encryption key to sign as well, then the easiest thing to do is to create a certificate request where you basically stick the public key and some identifying information for yourself inside something that you sign with the private key, and you and we misuse, we abuse the encryption key here and use it as a signing key as well, and we create two signed messages, and we just send those across in a Kerberos encrypted message to the CA. Okay? The CA, you've established a relationship with the CA, so you've got the shared secret KCCA, that's the Kerberos key. So the fact that that message decrypts tells the CA that the message came from you. It can then associate and check that the username you stuck in your request was the same as what was associated with your Kerberos ticket. It can then verify the signatures on both messages. You've put the public key in the message. It can check that it verifies the signatures. Well, that tells it proof of possession on the two keys. And then it can issue certs. And then it just signs some certs. It creates a binding between your public key and the name, signs it with the private key, and sends them back to you. And that was sort of the easiest enrollment protocol. You're just leveraging the fact Kerberos, you're using the encryption that exists to prove that you are who you say you are because you've logged into the Kerberos realm, and then it's just using the signatures keys. So does everyone kind of get that as a baseline? I see nodding heads. That's good. I see nodding heads in Regiment. That's good. Now, what if you can't sign with the encryption key? Okay, so this is just another possible solution, okay? But I want to give you a flavor for what happens, because this is a common problem. In particular, imagine that you've got a hardware key that is encrypt only, and you cannot sign with it. And, you know, in a lot of sort of businesses, military, this sort of thing is possible. You'll get completely separation of duty. You'll get two keys that are hardware tokens, and you just can't encrypt with it. So one possibility is you could have done is added a challenge response round, where the server sends some number and says, please encrypt this number, or the client sends up the encryption, or actually it wouldn't go that way. The client would send up the public encryption key, the server would send the challenge back encrypted, and then make the client decrypt it and send it back. And you could do something like that. Here's another trick you can do. You can encrypt the cert in the reply so that you basically hand this, you issue the cert before you have proof of possession that the guy has the encryption key. But in order to make use of the cert, he must successfully decrypt it. This is how that works. Proceeds just like before, except you send an unsigned request. You could also sign it with your signature key. But think about what you do is I'm basically going to take my public encryption key and I'm going to say to the server, I'm going to claim this is my key. You're going to have to trust me on that just for the moment. And what the server does is it says, okay, I'm going to kind of believe that you're not, you know, it's likely you're not lying to me. I'm going to go ahead and issue a cert. Okay, so, you know, I get, here come in the cert requests. I verify the signature on the signature key and everything's okay. What I then do is I send back the encryption cert encrypted to the user. Now, if the user lied to me and gave me the wrong key pair, that encrypted cert is useless to him. And all it's cost me is I've now got to revoke a cert if I never get anything back from him that I've issued, because it's now in the wild, but no one's ever gotten hold of it. If that is his key, he'll be able to decrypt it and then use the cert and move on from there. And this actually was, there was actually a fight within the IETF over whether to do enrollment using this style or whether using the other style. And so one of the reasons I bring it up is this was one of the techniques that actually was a point of discussion for a number of years inside of the PKIX group. And so that's just one technique that you can do with encrypt-only stuff. And that was that question. Now, having done any of those sort of solutions, go on to question three, and you say modify it to do key escrow, where as part of my request go into the server, I now have to send the private encryption key, and the server now needs to verify that the private encryption key matches the public encryption key that he's been given. In this case, you don't actually have to do a separate proof of possession round for the private encryption key, because you have both of them. The CA sees both, and he can test them. All the CA's got to do is say, well, you gave me an encryption key, you gave me the public part, you gave me the private part, let me do some operation and see if it works. Okay, I believe they're a matched pair. Fine, I'll go give you a cert on it because you've met the deposit requirements. And that was basically all there was to that problem. Question back here.
So it seemed like there was an efficiency problem there because it has to do a couple of encryption decryption operations and you've got a large user load. Is there a way to make that more efficient?
Well, you could, let's think about that. I'd have to think about that offline to see if there's some way without the server having to check. You might be able to do the same sort of thing where you do a challenge and you make the server do it, so you only have to do a, you do a decrypt. So based on the asymmetry between whether the encrypt or the decrypt operation is faster, you could potentially actually have the, send a challenge down to the user, right, if it was fast to encrypt, say. You could actually encrypt something down, have the server decrypt and send, well no, because even then wouldn't. Tell you what, let's talk about it a little later, because I'm not sure if there's any, if there's a way to get around the fact, because at the end of the day, the server's got to have some proof that that key that he holds is what's going to trigger. Maybe he flips it the other way. Maybe what he does is he encrypts, or he gets the client to do the encryption, and he does a decrypt or something along those lines. Yeah. But, you know, you still have to know that you got a match set and you haven't been faked out.
So if the server, if the server's going to escrow the key anyway, it could just generate the key for the client, right, and send it down.
Yes. In fact, that's a good point. There was a question that came up over the, a couple people asked me that over the weekend was, is it okay to do server-side key gen? In general, the answer is no for signature keys, because you want that minimizing the repudiation capability. In some cases, you can do server-side key gen for encryption keys. It kind of depends, again, on the hardware situation and things like that. If you're doing software-based keys, you could do a server-side key gen in a known way, which kind of gets around your problem because the server actually generates at that point and then hands it back to the client and the client stores it. In other situations, you want hardware-based stuff where you may not be able to inject a key in, although you have to get it out in the first place to send it up. So you might be able to do that for the encryption key gen. I see people go back and forth on that, you know, whether folks do it or not. It seems to be out of favor at the moment, but there are times when it was in favor. So, kind of depends. Question here.
It's like encrypting the private key with the Kerberos session key is not paranoid enough, because the TGS also has that session key.
That's true, and I'm not trying to defend against, I'm assuming a non-malicious TGS this. Well, okay, so now you're all going to beat me up because I gave you a problem set 5 weeks ago or something where the TGS was malicious. That's true. I'm sorry, what? You trust the TGS. You see, you know, some trust, some don't. If you didn't want to, if you had, of course, what you could do is you could do a public key encryption. If you had the public key of the CA, you could form an S/MIME encrypted message, and you could encrypt it to the CA so the CA knows it.
That's exactly the approach I took. That's I know the CA has a public key because they had to authenticate to another CA somewhere. There's a root
that's
CA
true,
somewhere.
But they may only have a signing key. You don't know they necessarily have encryption capability on that. But they probably do, but, you know, there is that possibility as well, right, where, again, where you've got separation of duty. If you were only doing a signature algorithm and they didn't support for RSA but only like DSA, then you may not be able to pull that trick. But that's a fair answer too.
A continuous battle with my coworkers is that they are not paranoid enough, and I have to keep working on them.
Well, if one of the things you take away from this class is the need that all of your coworkers need to be even more paranoid, that's a good thing. Okay, I think that's a question.
So just to follow up on that argument, if the TGS is assumed malicious, can it masquerade as the user and just ask for a cert?
Yes, it could. Yeah.
So it's kind of like it's becomes one of that line, isn't it?
Well, then we get back to where we talk about how malicious is the TGS, and is it passive versus active attacker? And
fair enough, but
in this case, yes.
I just meant in this case, the binding of authenticity of the client is based on TGS, so if that can be assumed, then
that's correct. That's an absolutely fair point in this case, right? Well, the premise behind the problem was that if the Kerberos authentication succeeds, you kind of know that the user is logged in, and you blew it that. All right, let's go on the rollover for the night. So problem four was fun with chain building. And the basic idea was I gave you these simplified certs that had an issuer name, a subject public key, and a validity period with various overlaps. I apologize for the typo that was on the problem. I think everyone got the fix in email. And to think about what happens when you do rollover and how do you keep the identity certs continuing to validate over a period of time when the intermediate CA has to roll. And this is, again, a real practical problem that happens because often your identity certs are sitting in hard-to-service devices. They're either on every user's machine, which you can service when they connect to the network, or they're on smart cards, which are harder, or they're sitting in hardware devices like wireless access points or things like that. And so often you end up playing these tricks in practice when you want to manipulate your PKI to keep from servicing all of the end seats. It's just the same as how do I play a trick on the server so I don't have to go and install some patch on every client machine in my enterprise. Okay, the same general idea. So question 4A was, all right, assume that, you know, T1 less than T2 less than T3 less than T4, which means that this time period is completely before this time period here. And what can you do to make end entity certs validate without reissuing them? Okay. And the answer here was to come up with what's called a cross certificate. And what you do is you have the new CA. So remember what you got is here's my old cert. My old cert is signed with key K1, which is the CA's old key. Here's the new chain that's going to be in effect. And this doesn't chain directly because his public key is K2. So I need a cert that's signed with K2 that claims to certify K1 that I can chain through. And note that it's going to be the CA calling. It's sort of not quite self-signed because the keys are different, but the issuer name and the subject name are the same, and I can chain through it. So the goal behind this is what's called a cross certificate. We talked about it with the bridge CA, and now basically the CA is just doing it on its own to sort of patch in the hierarchy, okay, over this new validity period. That was the answer to problem 4A.
Your validity period is starting at T3.
Yes.
What happens between T2 and T3 for the end users?
My understanding is they go get a beer, according to the message off the mailing list.
I would think that you would make that the transition one cover from T2 to T4.
You're right.
So the end user didn't blow
up. You could do that, except for the following fact. If I make this, let me erase. If I make this T2 to T4, it's still not going to chain between T2 and T3, right? So let's say I make this T2 to T4.
Yeah, but at least it fails because the CA fails rather than failing because the end user thinks they have a bad cert.
Well, it'll fail on one of these two intermediates, right? It'll fail here for T2 to T3 because this one's not time valid. Now, in practice, it actually goes the other way, which is what you did in 4B,
right,
is you get overlap, and they kind of roll, and they make sure there's some period where there's always something good. Okay, I kind of contrived it a little bit in this problem so that I could swap the endpoints in 4B.
The other issue is that two end users that are underneath the CA can still serve with each other if that transition covers the whole period, even if the CA can't get to the root.
Well, but they...
Because your certification goes up where you have a common CA.
Well, yes, but that's not a trusted root because it's not a self-signed trusted root. So under the standard chain building policy, even though they both chain to a common point, you'd have to modify the trust policy on the machine to say, yeah, okay, it's an intermediate, but I'm explicitly going to trust it anyway. Some programs let you do that. Default chain building would say no, that you could only, that the chain has to terminate in a trusted root certificate that's self-signed. Okay, so it depends on your chain acceptance policy. But that's a good point. All right, the final question. Now swap the endpoints so you get some overlap and make it so that old certs certify with the new CA and the new certs certify with the old CA. And the point with this was that you needed two cross certs. And this is really, we call this old with new and new with old. So you have the old CA. This is old with new. I may have them backwards. Okay, but the idea is that the old CA key signs the new one, and the new CA key signs the old one, and from T3 on, this new one certifying the old one goes up. This one only has to go up to T2 because this one's going to die at T2. But that way you actually can get, so this is an old certificate. That's one issued under the old CA. Here's a new one. And yet he chains through to the old CA and the new CA. And that's the whole point.
Why do you need the new one chaining through the bridge when it's got a new CA down on the bottom line it can get to? Why didn't it go to the new all the way through?
So if it turned out that the only time you probably need that is that if this cert gets pushed to a device that happens to have this preloaded for it and you don't send the new intermediate along. That's the most common scenario that happens, is that based on what certificates are already present somewhere, you end up doing, you do something like that.
Would you accept the other answer?
The will...
I interpreted that problem as, well, the new one's going to go through because...
That's fine. If you... if you said that the new one would chain through the new CA as of T... I guess that's true. Yeah. As of T3, it would anyway. And it would... so it would go... I guess it would still go through here directly, right?
Well...
No, it wouldn't. It has to go through this one. It has to go through here.
No, it goes down to the third box down. The bottom line.
It goes down here because it's signed with K2.
Next box over, third box.
Actually, it could go... Yeah, you're missing this one. You're going to say it goes this way directly.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's probably true as well. Yeah, that would be okay. That would be okay. I guess.
So,
question here.
One thing I don't understand, can the entity have a certificate, say, for a year, and that certificate be signed with the CA certificate, which is valid for a week? So.
Okay. You have just touched on a piece of religion. Okay.
Yeah, and basically, my related question will be,
yeah.
In my solution to this problem, I assume that for me to verify a chain, I only need to verify that basically that when the chain was created, at that time, every certificate in the chain was valid. So, which actually very much simplifies this whole problem. If at the time when the chain was created, every right. certificate was valid, and then it expired, say every certificate was valid for a week only. But
okay.
Only the end entity certificate has to be valid, really, at the time of verification.
Okay, so that... We should talk more because there's a religious issue there. Let me try to give you the summary of it, okay? In one, the way in which chain building's first off defined as far as PKIX is concerned is that there is an evaluation time that is fed into the algorithm, okay? And you can choose what time that is. Either now, typically it's at right now. You could choose to make it be sometime in the past. And that all of the certs have to be valid at that period in time. A very common case when you actually don't use today's, the current time, but something else, is when you use it with timestamping, and you want to say, I want to know if the signature was valid at the time at which the doc was signed, and I've got a timestamp attesting to it. Whether or not time intervals have to nest, okay, was a long actual argument. In fact, it was one of the first arguments I got into with my dev lead at Microsoft, because the spec doesn't require that, and he required it, and for about two releases of Internet Explorer, we refused to chain validate certs that didn't nest properly because he was completely convinced that that's the way in which chains ought to work. The problem is it basically confuses a lot of this rollover. You'd have to resign a lot of stuff, that's right, because if it expires every week, it blows everything away. Now, there are some good reasons for that, which is if you're only willing to stand up for the CA for a week, you can argue, well, why should you be willing to accept an EE cert for longer?
The acceptance is up to the verifying
party. To the verifying, well, it's tied in with both, right? Ultimately, the verifier has to choose what his verification policy is, right? You're right on that. But then there's also a liability limit on the other side. So, you know, and it kind of goes both ways.
Liability, anyway, explicitly in the cert, it says that it already expired.
So they'd say there's nothing, and then it's up to you to decide whether or not you're willing to accept or not. Yes?
That cert could also have extension info. They can say how long the EE certs that it issues are allowed to last, right? So it could expire in a week, but be allowed to issue for a year.
I'm not sure. I have to go check if is there an extension for that? I'd actually have to go look at that. I mean, there's a basic constraint would let you say whether or not it's allowed to issue or not. Name constraints wouldn't give you that. There might be one that would let you construct that, but I'm actually not familiar with an extension off the top of my head that's well understood that would let you do it. You could imagine such a thing existed. Certainly, that's a possibility, where you could put a further constraint on the issuance policy.
Okay.
But that's a good question too. I mean, the fact is. All of these sorts of things as to what you... The one point I want to come back to is what you said about the time at which the chain was created. And the fact is that it's true that at issuing time, things... You could have a case where you issue a cert into the future. And at the time at which you actually issued the cert wasn't quite valid yet because you're buying it in advance for some sort of rollover. So there are... You can get kind of fast and loose with these two. Okay? Any other question on the problem set? I'm kind of running... All right. Great.
Brian?
Thanks.
Perfect. Brian?
Yes. Question?
Yeah.
Okay.
A little bit, not directly on one of these questions, but about cert management. Is there a cryptographic reason why Outlook won't let me send encrypted mail to somebody whose key I have, encryption key I have, if I don't have my own encryption and signing keys?
Oh, you know, the wait, it should let you send an encrypted mail even if you don't have a key from a crypto perspective. It's possible that from a message format perspective that you can't actually generate a valid SMIME format message if you don't have a valid signer or sender info. Possibly. I'd have to go look at the spec on that. I suspect that there's probably a non-cryptographic reason for that. And I can certainly point you to the right people to go express your displeasure with. Okay? But that's a good point. I don't actually know off the top of my head on that. The only thing I can think of is you can actually generate an SMIME message without having a cert, even if you had exchange keys directly, because the message format requires an issuer name and serial number somewhere in the format. And if you don't have certs, you actually can't construct a legal SMI message. So that's the only thing I could think of off the top of my head. Okay. All right. There you go.
Okay. Thank you.